Good evening, and thank you for coming to the Burgage Hall. It hasn't cooled down in here since this afternoon, really, has it? And the poetry is going to be hot as well. So if you don't know, I'm Jill Abram, and I'm event managing and introducing this evening. As always, I'd like to thank the Arts Council, without whom this festival wouldn't happen, and also Jo Kingham, who has generously sponsored this particular event. Thank you, Jo. So we have a fantastic reading tonight with Raymond Antrobus, Peter Raynaud and Josephine Corcoran. And there's a lot of generous people in the poetry community, and these three definitely up there at the top of the tree. First to read will be Josephine Corcoran and her new book, What Are You After? And as usual, all the books are at the Three Counties bookstall on sale at the back of the room. Josephine's book is brand new. It's also hot, actually, off the press, and that's published by Nine Arches. One of the generous things that Josephine does is that she has a blog called And Other Poems, and she publishes other people's poems on that. So if you haven't checked it out, you can see some fantastic poets on that and other poems. And in fact, Raymond was just saying that he thinks his first ever published poem was on that blog. So I'm really looking forward to hearing Josephine read. She's also written a play and a short story for radio some time ago, and they were repeated recently. And so I'm hoping that she'll write some more, so I might actually get to work with her in my other capacity as a sound effects maker for radio drama. So, but tonight's going to be poems. Please welcome Josephine Corcoran.
Honeymoon. I wouldn't call it a honeymoon, those muffled nights in mothballed rooms. With cake in the boot, we pilgrim north, taking a young marriage to old widows. My father's brothers dead, their crucifixes still hanging. In each house, we were given the double bed. My aunties inviting us to fornicate on concave mattresses, dead men's seed. Had we come 1 week before, you would have been given nothing but dusty blankets on a downstairs floor. I would have sunk alone and deep into the mildewed sponge of a cousin's bed. My aunties would have spread as wide as angels in their marital sheets, their doors ajar, the solemn whispers of their nighttime prayers beating as sweet as deathbed lovemaking. But our wedding vows were said, so we sipped tea on upright chairs still dimpled from brill-creamed heads, and rolled like screws in sideways jars on shelves in locked-up sheds. 7 years, one son, one daughter later, Jesus has been sent to us. The aunts are gone, their houses stripped. His legs are broken, long marriages thrown into landfill, and we laugh when our little children ask about our honeymoon. I see you dreaming down our garden path, the broken body in your hands. You are picturing the twist of wire you'll use to bind his legs, the nail, the hammer, the spirit level, the pencil mark, the place he'll eternally outstare us. I love the way our daughter sings as her finger traces our wedding rings. I started with that poem because in many ways it's the first poem I wrote, and it's certainly the first thing I wrote after a long time of not being able to write. As Jill mentioned, I started off writing prose and plays. And at the time, I've been trying to write about my own honeymoon for a long time, and it just couldn't come as a short story. And I was working as a teaching assistant in our local comprehensive school and helping GCSE English literature students with their exams. So I was reading what they were reading, which was a lot of Seamus Heaney. And it was reading Heaney that thought perhaps I could write about it as a poem. So I do like to think there's a little bit of Seamus Heaney in there. I should be so lucky. I'd like to think of myself as a joyful person, but I have experienced pain in my life, and I don't know if you have to experience pain in order to be joyful. I'm not sure if that's how it works, but like a lot of people, I've experienced miscarriage, and I never intended to write about my miscarriage at all. It just what happened was, it just came to me. I was overwhelmed one day with this sense of life that had been a part of me. And there was, Murray Howe has written more than one poem, but it's something really struck me. She writes about characters in her poems looking sideways out of the window to the right, where they say the unlived life is. And it was with that, the spirit of those lines, that set the tone for a sequence of poems about miscarriages, which I wrote. So the first one I'll read is Supermoon, September 2014. The twins who left us waited 13 years for me to see them, as if I never twisted like a pepper grinder or held the liver of them in my hands. They appear as easily as footballs thrown over next door's hedge. The sky has given up its hope of holding on to them. And you and I stand close as lovers in a gallery, the window framing an empty night, our interlocking fingers full of all that we withhold from one another. You say it's a bomber's moon, gardens lit up like tablecloths, owls calling the unlived lives of rabbits and mice. What if tonight blue-washed beaches spill over with teenagers, their parents nowhere to be seen as they swim in the high tide? Miscarriage. To miss, to not reach, to not get, to not have, to fail. To know others have not failed, to not win, to not be, to not know, to lose, to almost have, to imagine, then lose, to never know, to always know you haven't, to always never have, not quite, to not keep, to not own, to not possess, to come close, then fail, to cause hope to rise and fall, to be the cause of disappointment, to bring about and cause to fade applause, to be pitied, to be given to and stolen from, to hear laughter swallowed, to be hope as it leaves, to let slip, to watch fall, to be the falling, to dream you have, you are, you did, you are doing. To lose over and over again in dreams. To hold again in dreams. To be lost. To know what you haven't. To feel brushed against the lightest touch. Happiness perhaps not never was to hold and not. To not arrive. To long for. Carriage is fairy tale, is fragile, is made of glass, is made of pumpkin, is brought to life, is made, is godmother made, is manufactured, is fashioned, is dreamed about, is drawn up, is horse-drawn, is at midnight, is awaiting, is climbed into, stepped inside, is fallen asleep in, is rocking, is moonlight-filled, is speeding with precious cargo inside, is rushing to meet, is gazed from, gazed into. I had, after a series of miscarriages, I'm very lucky to have, I have two wonderful children who are now 17 and 19. But I brought them up as Catholic, and in the Catholic tradition, when they were about 12, they received the sacrament of confirmation, which is when they reaffirm the baptismal vows, which I had made for them as when they were babies. They were able to choose a holy name. So they chose the names Esther and Ezekiel. And the book of Esther is I think it's the only book in the Bible which doesn't directly mention God. And there's a reference in here to a pulp fiction by Tarantino. So I like to imagine, I'm a very gentle, pacifist person, but for some reason both of my children are very drawn to violent films. So there's a reference to that, to Samuel L. Jackson, who quotes Ezekiel. So it's Esther and Ezekiel. When it came to confirmation, my girl and boy chose Old Testament names with matching letters, as if they knew that in their toddler days they were mistaken for twins. Those of us who believe in the Holy Spirit forgive our children for receiving the sacrament under false pretenses, for pocketing gifts. Faith is a long journey, our priest says. I offer up my doubts and, like Esther, never mention God or miscarriage in ordinary life. Nor do I talk about Samuel L. Jackson when asked why my son chose that name. This time, prayers have outlived violence. He knows the lines by heart, as sure as Tarantino of their provenance. Blessed is he who, in the name of charity and goodwill, shepherds the weak through the valley of the darkness, for he is truly his brother's keeper and the finder of lost children. My name's Josephine, and I like visiting France. I go there quite a lot. In fact, when I was in my 20s, I worked for a couple of years as an au pair in Paris. But whenever I go away, I like to kid myself that I can speak French. I make the mistakes that often we make sometimes, mixing up my avoir to have with être to be. And I've made the mistake of asking for la guerre rather than la guerre, the war, not the station. So, but I always like to have a go, I always like to have a go, even if I make an idiot of myself. So this is called Speaking French. At the beach bar, a man half my age is centimetre from my sanded breasts, as beautiful as the café crème between us. And what I still call centimes lie blurred and glittered on my upturned palm. I am not my pair of glasses, I confide. What have I learned since a driver shouted down the bus that I had asked him for a ticket to the war? That I would rather mime my girlfriend's diarrhea than be the man standing in a crowded pharmacy chanting English, English, as if these syllables are all it takes to halt ridicule and stomachache. So my name's Josephine. I'm Josephine Marie. I'm born near Christmas, so I've been named after Joseph and Mary. And it's a name I find that travels very well. In France and Italy and Portugal and Spain, and everyone understands Josephine, but it doesn't do quite so well here in England. People really like to shorten it or like to point out to me, mention Napoleon, and this happens. But that never happens to me in Paris. So this is Poem in Which I Am Josephine in Paris. Catherine Deneuve throws me the keys to her Rive Gauche apartment, kisses the air above both of my ears. I'm wearing her heels, shift dress, silk-lined coat. My lipstick in place from my 7 a.m. Café Noir to my 7 p.m. Coupe de Champagne. My hair has just left the salon gleam. At parties, no one pretends to be an emperor or jokes that tonight's not the night. No one calls me Joe, as if one syllable is all I deserve. At outdoor cafes, waiters bring me tray after tray of blossom-filled boulevards. The River Seine lights up our faces. We're always on a film set. When my husband calls my name, I hear the sound of a figure skater turning, a delicious froth of consonants. Josephine. On every street corner, we stop to kiss. And I'll just end, actually, with a love poem for my husband. And we've been together 24 years. And it's also, I guess, a love poem for the National Health Service, which is appropriate with it being 70, having its birthday this week. And it's love in the time of hospital visits. And thank you very much for being such a really welcoming and attentive audience. The first, I think, was my ankle, bandaged as if the nurse was wrapping flowers after it bloomed shamelessly when I'd leapt from a stile on College Lane and danced in the Union Bar. Next, your face. A rugby boot tore it open like a love letter, and a doctor sealed it, not with a kiss, but with stitches. Who needs fireworks with an appendix like yours bursting into our relationship? Secretly, I was relieved I hadn't, after all, poisoned you with my salmon. You came to find me when snow-white linen turned redder than a dozen roses. Luckily, hospitals are equipped to deal with all human spillages. We've done our share of mopping. Together we've seen embryos swimming past us on a screen. One of them seemed to wave as if to say she'd be our daughter soon. She kept her word. Another time we learned by ultrasound we had a son when he rudely somersaulted. In 24 years we've lost count of all the body parts we've seen, lost most of our inhibitions, lost blood, skin, bone, joints, teeth, hair and dignity, taken surreptitious snapshots of each other wearing long white stockings. And each time, it seems to me, there have always been wheat fields artfully photographed, swaying, and whales in black and white images spraying air down airless corridors, endless miles of linoleum, perfume of boiled rice, base note of disinfectant. And in 24 years, the smokers wearing lace-ups with their dressing gowns still haven't finished their cigarettes or moved from the wooden bench parked behind the ambulances. We have seen each other going under and coming round. My love for you is as sound as the money we've invested in hospital car parks. Even without your appendix or your real knees, your shoulder, groin, Achilles tendon, face all rearranged, your ears reattached, your prostate gone missing, you're someone I can rely on to bring me gladness, sometimes in a disposable cup. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you, Josephine. I'm sure you didn't get into as much trouble as my friend in France who got her vocabulary wrong and instead of asking for jam to spread on her toast, asked for condoms. Raymond Antrobus is a very fine fellow. He's a fellow of the Complete Works, which is a mentoring scheme for poets of colour in this country. There are 30 of those. He is a fellow of Carve Carnum, which is a kind of very intense summer school in America for poets of Caribbean and African origin. And although there are quite a lot of those, there are only three of those who've come from Britain, and Raymond is the latest. He's a Gerwood Compton fellow. There are only three of those in existence, and there are actually two of them in this room. The other one being Jane Kamane. And that's a scheme for poets who have given a lot to the community. And obviously Ray has done that. And it's for that fellowship, they get money and they get mentoring and various other support to support them in their own personal writing. But I think they're all also using that to be able to give back even more to the community. Ray recently won the Geoffrey Dermer Prize, which is a prize given to the best poem of the year in the Poetry Review. And he has chosen to give half of his winnings to the National Deaf Children's Society, not only to support the education of deaf children, but to highlight how the budgets for that have been cut. As a poet, he has a pamphlet out called To Sweet and Bitter, which is available at the back, published by Outspoken. And his debut collection is due on the 1st of October, published by Penned in the Margins. So please welcome Raymond Antrobus.
Wow. Thanks, Jill, for that great introduction. Great reading from Josephine as well, brilliant. Thank you to Lebury, thank you to Chloe for having me, it's an honour. First time here. I think I'm going to dedicate this whole set to, as Josephine said, the NHS, 70 years of the NHS. I've had 10 years of speech and hearing therapy through them, which I didn't have to pay for, which I wouldn't be able to afford without them. And to the Windrush generation, as they're being called at the moment. First poem I'm going to read, who here has been to Barcelona? Wicked. Who here has been to Gaudi's Cathedral? Great, okay. All right, so big you all up. This poem began in Gaudi's Cathedral just shortly after my father passed away. And I was just looking for a way to process grief. And in Gaudi's Cathedral, if you do the audio guide, there's a certain section of the cathedral that has a very unorthodox shaped roof, and it encourages you to go to that part of the church, look up and shout or sing and be vigilant of how sound moves in that space. And I'm having this experience through Bluetooth headphones, which are going into my hearing aids, and I'm wondering if this is how angels experience sound. Am I included in that elevation? Echo. My ear amps whistle as if singing to echo, goddess of noise. The raveled knot of tongues, of blaring birds, consonant crumbs, of dull doorbells, sounds swamped in my misty hearing aid tubes. Gaudi believed in holy sound and built a cathedral to contain it, pulling hearing men from their faded knees as though deafness was a kind of atheism. Who would turn down God? Even though I have not heard the golden decibel of angels, I have been living in a noiseless palace where the doorbell is pulsating light, and I am able to answer. What? A word that keeps looking in mirrors as if it is in love with its own volume. What? I am a one-word question, a one-man patience test. What? What language would we speak without ears? What? Is paradise a world where I hear everything? What? How will my brain know what to hold if it has too many arms? The day I clear out my dead father's flat, I throw away boxes of moulding LPs, Garvey, Malcolm X, Mandela, speeches on vinyl. I find a TDK cassette tape on the shelf. The smudge green label reads, Raymond speaking. I play the tape in his vintage cassette player and hear my two-year-old voice chanting my name, Antrob, and Dad's laughter crackling in the background, not knowing I couldn't hear the word bus and wouldn't until I got my hearing aids. Now I sit here listening to the space of deafness. Antrob. 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 And if you don't catch nothing, then something wrong with your ears. They've been tuned to the wrong frequency. Kai Miller. So maybe I belong to the universe underwater, where all songs are smeared wailings for Selassie, goddess of salt water, healer of infected ears, which is what the doctor thought I had, since deafness did not run in the family, but came from nowhere. So they syringed olive oil and salt water, and we all waited to see what would come out. And no one knew what I was missing until a doctor gave me a handful of Legos and said to put a brick on the table every time I heard a sound. After the test, I still held enough bricks in my hand to build a house and call it my sanctuary, call it the reason I sat in saintly silence during my grandfather's sermons where he preached the good news I only heard as Babylon's babbling echoes. So the second language I speak is British Sign Language, or SSE, Sign Assisted English. I've spent a year working with deaf young people around London, mainly. And I was in the States, and every country, every nation, every spoken language had its own sign language. So I've also been trying to pick up a little bit of American Sign Language. So for this next poem, just to give context, this is how you say alive in American Sign Language, alive. British Sign Language, live, living. Also means toilet, which is weird, but alive. When Daniel Harris stepped out of his police car, the policeman was waiting, gun raised. I use the past tense, though this is irrelevant in Daniel's language, which is sign. Sign has no future or past, it is a present language. You are never more present when a gun is pointed at you. What language says this, if not sign? But the police officer saw hands waving in the air, fired, and Daniel dropped his hands, his chest bleeding out into the concrete meters from his home. And I'm in New York coffee house reading this news on my phone when a black policewoman walks in, two guns on her hips. My friend next to me reading the comment section, Black Lives Matter. Now what could we sign or say out loud when the last word I learned in American Sign Language was alive, alive. Both thumbs pointing at your lower abdominal, index fingers pointing up like two guns in the sky. This next poem, Josephine had so many themes, really powerful themes throughout her reading, and so I quickly wrote this list, and water was always an interesting one, and bodies of water. I think I'm going to try reading this poem. I promised myself at every reading I'll try and read something I've never read before. I wrote this in response to a poem by a very obscure poet that no one here has heard of, I guarantee it. His name is Ted Hughes, and he wrote this poem called Deaf School, and I'm not going to read it. I do have it in my in my book, just erased, because it's a strange poem. I think any poem that compares children to monkeys is strange. So I wanted to respond to Ted Hughes, and I wanted to find a way to do it. And I happened to be in this place called New Orleans while I was reading this poem. And I was sitting in this cafe right next to the Mississippi River. Has anyone here been to New Orleans? Wicked. Big up the New Orleans crew. Amazing place, because you hear so much about its mysticism and its energy. And so it's a real thing. And the energy of New Orleans and the Mississippi River came into this poem. And it's called After Reading Deaf School by Ted Hughes by the Mississippi River. No one wise calls the river unaware or simple pools. No one wise says it lacks a dimension. No one wise says Its body is removed from the vibration of air. The river is a quiet breath taker, gargling mud. Ted is alert and simple. Ted lacked a subtle, wavering aura of sound and responses to sound. Ted lived through his eyes. But I, the colossal currents from the bridge, I, riverboats ghosting a geography of fog. Mississippi means big river, named by French colonizers. The natives laughed at their arrogant maps, conquering wind and marking mist. The mouth of the river laughs. A man in a wetsuit emerges, pulls misty goggles over his head. Couldn't see a thing. He breathes heavily. My face was in darkness. No one heard him. The river drowned him out. It was my dad who taught, who, like, I have all these memories of being read to by my dad primarily. And there's this book called Happy Birthday Moon. I don't know if anyone here has heard of that book, but it's a picture book. And it's about this bear that has this fascination with the moon. And I know about the thing about poets and moons. So it kind of could have been indoctrinated with me at an early stage. But the interesting thing about this book is that at the beginning it talks about the importance of reading to your children. And at this point, I couldn't read and write properly until I was about 11 years old, because deafness was discovered late. And so all of my school reports, just can't read, can't write in a straight line. And this poem is dedicated to my dad, and it's also dedicated to parents who read to their children. It's a pantoum, and it's called Happy Birthday Moon. Dad reads aloud. I follow his finger across the page. Sometimes his finger moves past words, tracing white space. He makes the moon say something new every night to his deaf son who slurs his speech. Sometimes his finger moves past words, tracing white space. Tonight he gives the moon my name, but I can't say it. His deaf son who slurs his speech. Dad taps the page, says, try again. Tonight he gives the moon my name, but I can't say it. I say, Reynan Akobok. He laughs. Dad taps the page, says, try again. But I like making him laugh. I say my mistake again. I say, Reynan Akobok. He laughs, says, Raymond, you're something else. I like making him laugh. I say my mistake again. Reynan Akobok, what else will help us? He says, Raymond, you're something else. I'd like to be the moon, the bear, even the rain. Reynan Akobok, what else will help us hear each other, really hear each other? I'd like to be the moon, the bear, even the rain. Dad makes the moon say something new every night, and we hear each other, really hear each other. As Dad reads aloud, I follow his finger across the page. This is my last poem. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for hearing. This poem is dedicated to all of the students who I've worked with, all of the deaf teachers of the deaf. Who, as Jill has said, this country has lost 4 million in support for deaf teachers and deaf young people, and I just wouldn't be here without them. This poem is called Dear Hearing World. It's after a poet called Dinesh Smith, and BSL stands for British Sign Language. Thank you. Dear Hearing World, I've left Earth in search of sounder orbits. A solar system where the space between a star and a planet isn't empty. I have left a white beard of noise in my place, and many of you won't know the difference. We are indeed the same volume. All of us eventually fade. I've left Earth in search of an audible God. I do not trust the sound of yours. You would not recognize my grandmother's hallelujah if she had to sign it. You would have made her sit on her hands. You would have made her sit on her hands. Put a ruler in her mouth as if measuring her distance from holy. Take your God back. Though his songs are beautiful, they are not loud enough. I want the fate of Lazarus for every deaf school you've closed, every deaf child whose confidence has gone to a silent grave, every BSL user who has seen the annihilation of their language. I want these ghosts to haunt your tongue-tied hands. I have left Earth. I am equal parts sick of your, oh, I'm hard of hearing too, just because you've been on an aeroplane or suffered head colds. Your voice has always been the loudest sound in a room. I call you out for refusing to acknowledge sign language in classrooms, for assessing deaf students on what they can't say instead of what they can. They did not ask to be part of the hearing world. I can't hear my joints crack, but I can feel them. I am sick of sounding out your rules. You tell me I breathe too loud, and it is rude to make noise when I eat. Sent me to speech therapist, said I was speaking a language of holes, but I was pronouncing what I heard, but your judgment made all my syllables disappear. Your magic master trick, hearing world, drowning out the quiet, bursting all speech bubbles in my graphic childhood. You were glad to benefit from audio supremacy. I tried hearing people. I tried to love you, but you laughed at my deaf grammar. I used commas, not full stops, because everything I said kept running away. I mulled over long paragraphs because I didn't know what a natural break sounded like. You erased what could have always been poetry. Strike that out. You erased what could have always been poetry. Taught me I was inferior to standard English expression. I was a broken speaker. You were never a broken interpreter. Taught me my speech was dry for someone who just sound like they're underwater. And it took years to talk with a straight spine. I mute red marks on the coursework you assigned. Deaf voices go missing like sound in space. And I've left Earth to find them.
Thank you. That was powerful. Good luck with the new book. Oh, we need a moment, don't we, after that? So the last poet tonight is Peter Reynard. And like Josephine, he keeps a blog. It's called proletarianpoetry.com. And like Josephine's, it includes poems by other people. And they are poems of working class lives. I correct myself because he asked me for a poem. I said, you do know I'm middle class, don't you, Peter? And he said, every poet's got a working class poem inside them. And it turned out I did, and he published it, so thank you for that. Peter's, I'm the director of a collective called Malaika's Poetry Kitchen. You may have seen some of us here last year. And if I'm the head chef, Peter is very much the sous chef, my right-hand man. He's really supportive. He takes responsibility for things. He gives people a boot up the backside. And since he joined Kitchen, we've really been, on our mettle. He's been having a fantastic year, not one book, but two. This one, Precarious, is his debut collection, which came out in April, was it? With Smokestack. And this one, I'm very proud to say, is the result of a Malaika's Kitchen session that Karen McCarthy-Wolf led at the beginning of the year. It's called The Combination, but I'm going to let Peter tell you more about that. Please welcome Peter Reynard.
It's lovely to see so many people foregoing their love of football to be here tonight. I can't imagine there's many Brazilians or Belgians here, but if you are, thank you very much. I'd like to thank Jill, who's a complete hero as far as I'm concerned. I'd also like to thank Ledbury, particularly Chloe Garner, for inviting us here. But I'd also like to thank the people who host us poets, and Bella and Chris Johnson, who are here tonight. I stayed with them last year, and they are just the loveliest people for putting up with the likes of me. Yeah. And also that goes to everybody else who puts up with us. I'm going to start by taking us back to the 1980s. I grew up in an Irish area in Coventry. It was so Irish. The area is called Cowndon, so they named it County Cowndon. And my father's Scottish, so I was okay. I was the honorary jock. So I'm going to take you back to the 1980s when Thatcher was at her peak and Morrissey wasn't yet a racist. I hope you've all got your bingo tickets and your pens, because eyes down, for here is the first line. Maggie Thatcher, you can't match her. She's the darling of us all. She's the curse of the Irish nation, Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil. She's destroyed me higher purchase, and she's put me on the dole. And if I could only get my hands on her, I'd kick her up the hole. Maggie Thatcher, you can't match her, is railing on the jukebox for the fifth time that Sunday night. A time when the women are at home readying the kids for future failure, and an early night kicking off their blankets and wetting the bed. The old paddies full of pints and roasts, lost bets and building site wives, shout about how the old hoor is ruining the country they came over to build when they weren't paid enough to build their own. The young lads are all 1 in 10 UB40s, gabbing about the football, FAMI, and who's next for the beating at pool. Signing away their life at the social so they can still feel the cane-lined education across their arse. Everyone owes everyone else, so it's good, all good in this handshake economy. One lad buys a house off another who's going away for a year, and their days lengthen over outside events like the grey shadow of a cloak soaked in the blood of industrial resignation. Tommy sat amongst them, once a scuffle of calcium, now a Jenga of bones carved in the corner, with smoke gold fingers and no mind to argue with an empty glass. He's beaten down by the interventions of time, says he keeps hearing things he never said, wants someone to call him a psychiatrist next week. Any day will do, except for the ones he's dissolved in the drink. The lads tell him he's got the experience but not the qualifications. It's a joke he doesn't get, but no one makes the call either. By the middle of the week, Tommy's kitchen has music dancing off the walls without a guide rope. A few too many lines sees him shaking with uncertain psychosis and in need of the padded cell of plant food. So he takes off to the shop with the fairies for fags and skins to roll a coned one. Then sits in the company of a pigeon, decorating the bench with other white shit from the city's indulgence. Tommy smiles as a Hail Mary Jane takes to playing him a soothing tune. Meanwhile, his muscle-in-residence anabolic neighbour turns up at the empty flat to tell Tommy he's broken their keep-the-peace agreement, hammered out at 3 o'clock Monday morning over empty promises of a full bag of Superbrew. Your man spots Tommy powder floured across the table like the extravagance of an apprentice baker. He jibs him to the beasts, but not before stealing a line or three for his own well-tunnelled nostrils. So now Tommy's bored as a spirit level in an IKEA showroom, flat-packed on the lower deck in a 23-hour lockup. He suffers his top bunk's bucket list for when the great outdoors opens once again. This lad is little more than an 18-year-old roll-up, a career choice cock-up, a neck-tacked toe rag, useful as 90 pence in Poundland. He stinks of stale digestives. The lad needs crampons to cling to his delusion instead of slip-up plimsolls stolen from the pay-us-what-you-got shop. The lad says he knows the inside of a car inside out, cackles like a cauldron stirrer before showing Tommy his unfathered hands. For the next 6 weeks, he is nearly all Tommy will see, laid out on a diamond-wired spring-framed mattress, gabbing on like a trade description act in a 6x10 picture frame for Her Majesty's pleasure. Tommy was born in the day, but it wasn't yesterday. He's got his whole life behind him, and he's losing all feeling towards keeping another lad safe from a future stretched out dreaming at the ceiling. Our Tommy finally gets to see the psych. They listen to music together, with the door shut, in the prison's excuse for a chapel. Strings and piano keys echo through the rows of empty chairs, enough to give Tommy the steadies. And so, for 1 hour a week at least, he's free of all those fellas jabbering away in his head about Thatcher, the horses, football and the fanny. When Margaret Thatcher retired and was asked, "What was your greatest achievement?" she said, "New Labour." And we've had New Labour ever since. The Parliament of Rot. Maybe if we listen to the land, flouting all that was taught us, we can rout the certainty we were born into. For within this infinity of tiny deaths, there is a song we are instilled from. Maybe if we believe that fire's ember beneath our fingernails, we can scratch the face off this country. I tell you, within its bones is fated a painting so ulcerous it should never have been hung. When I was 16, I was diagnosed with Addison's disease. It's an autoimmune condition. And the endocrinologist said to me, "You have the insides of a middle-aged woman." And I was worried that it was going to give me a hysterectomy. But what it meant was that I had these conditions, and since I've had a number of them, like underactive thyroid, and the latest one is I don't produce any testosterone, is that I feel like I'm constantly having a menopause. So I'm absolutely dripping here at the moment internally. People have said to me, "Oh, you look really healthy and all that." Well, I can tell you not. Anyway, but the added to that is that I fought with masculinity all my life. I come from a working class background where I really didn't mix with any females until I was 30. I would go to the pub, and any night I would be there, there would be 10 to 50 lads I could sit and have a chat with. It was a great apprenticeship to masculinity, but the wrong kind. And I moved to London, and I met a friend of a friend out for a drink, and she said to me, "I've had a lovely evening, and I've never been in the company of someone who swore so much." I'm a little less rough around the edges, but still. Anyway, what a testosterone injection does is all the wrong things. It gives you a raging... yes, and it also makes you very angry. So one night, Friday night, I was walking to Malika's kitchen, and this guy blew a kiss out of me out of his works van, and I was fuming. But I wasn't fuming with him. I was fuming with myself that I was fuming with him. And it was how to deal with it. So as we tend to do, we write a poem. Testosterone injection. And it was 3 days after I had the injection. Passing a line of traffic with a dull ache in my right buttock, dressed to express a deep need to be anonymous, I hear the purse of a kiss from some paint-speckled cock of a bloke at the window of his mate's white van. I turn, wink as in a tick, smile, walk on. The dough balls double a laugh behind me. I try to resort to dormant, but can only compare notes. Does he not see? I too once have pulled an all-nighter, spilling into a Sunday morning football changing room full of towel-slapped arses with shrivelled cocks like a nest of baby birds, topped off with jokes about your mum's appetite for young men. Does he not see? I've drank with more to mix pay packet men. Does he not see? I was an end of the week bookie's wet dream, waging till my pockets were as vacant as my head. Does he not see I could get a crap tattoo from a mate with the misspelled name of an old flame still burning up my past? Does he not see I could harvest a generation of skinny chin kids from pebble dashed inner city landscapes? Does he not see I could give him a proper kiss? One I learned from my dad, who's from Glasgow. No? Then take this poem as a handshake. For how else can a real man see himself for what he really is? Right, so I'm going to try something new. It may work, it may not. Did you?
Oh, yes, sorry.
So for my sins, I started with a paragraph of the Communist Manifesto to do a poetic coupling with Karen McCarthy Wolfe. And then went home and said, all right, well, I'll try the preface. Okay, maybe I'll try section one. And then I did it all. But it's a poetic coupling, which means you take a line and you break it as you wish from a tract, whether a political tract, a speech, and you respond to it. So I had this conversation for 3 months with Karl Marx, trying to update it. And so what I'm going to do now is I'm going to invite a very special guest up to be Karl Marx for me. Please welcome Karl Moore. Kim Moore. What a don. Right.
I'm really scared.
So, look into my eyes. Not around my eyes, look at you're under. Now, Kim believes that she is Karl Marx now, and she is going to read the opening lines of the preface to the Communist Manifesto, to which I will respond. Are you all right, Karl?
Yes.
You're not going to get stroppy on me?
No.
Okay,
I'm
then.
I'm slightly worried about the pronunciation of some of these words.
It doesn't matter.
Okay.
Okay, are we ready?
Yeah.
Over to you.
3 hours. Sorry.
Just there, yeah.
Okay. A spectre is haunting Europe.
In it, though. What with Brexit, the refugee crisis, the rise of the far right.
The spectre of communism.
That red loose blanket in need of tucking in.
All the powers of old Europe have entered into a holy alliance to exorcise this spectre.
This unholy spectre come to remove the opium and Xanax from the ennui. It's ennui. I can't do ennui. I'm too working class. From the ennui of its existence.
Pope and Tsar, Metternich and Guizot, French radicals and German police spies.
Pope and President, Merkel, Macron, autoimmune free radicals of capitalism, each with an eye spy with my belittling eye.
Where is the party in opposition that has not been decried as communistic by its opponents in power?
Our Karl saw a gap in the market before the market had been fully formed.
Where is the opposition that has not hurled back the branding reproach of communism?
No one likes us. No one likes us. No one likes us. We don't care. We are commies, dirty commies. We are commies from over there.
Against the more advanced opposition parties, as well as against its reactionary adversaries.
We are coming with sickles and fists, hammers and Molotovs, balaclavas and masks. Give it up for Kim Moore, please. So I'm going to leave you with this last poem. Thanks for listening. And it's about me. And I've read this poem in front of Daljit Nagra. And Daljit Nagra said to me, "That is true, what you have in there about me." So here we go. Probably the best poet in the world. Most nights I enter poetry competitions. Big ones, small ones. Ones with themes, ones for a good cause. I win them all, but I don't take the winnings. You see, I enter as a well-known poet. When they win, they never let on it wasn't them. I assume that they assume they would have won anyway. I've won as Alice Oswald and Simon Armitage. Daljit Nagra's forward prize for best single poem is one of mine. I was once accused of plagiarism. Hands up, I did it. Obviously, I was not wise enough. We all try to learn from the best. I then won a major prize for Andrew Motion with an original poem about fornicating flies. I laughed my socks off as he stuttered over the alliteration when reading to hundreds of people at the Royal Festival Hall. No one called me a thief without a stumble and fall. Thank you.